The Theonauts Podcast.
Christian news from around the globe.
In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth.
It is the glory of God to conceal a thing, but the honor of kings is to search out a matter.
Explore the vast reaches of God's Word.
Welcome to the Theonauts Podcast, Episode 4. I'm David Gaddy.
I'm Jeremiah Orr.
And together we are the Theonauts. But wait! We've got an extra Theonaut in the studio today.
Honorary. Huh?
Yeah, honorary Theonaut.
That's great.
We have with us my son-in-law, Stephen Gerald. Welcome to the show.
Hey. Welcome, Stephen.
Thanks, guys. I'm kind of scared to be here, but we'll...
It's a lot of fun, don't worry.
He said he doesn't have much to bring to the show, but we're going to make sure he does.
His good looks and demeanor.
Moral support.
That's right.
A face meant for radio.
Beautiful. That's wonderful.
So how's everybody's week going?
Oh, pretty good. I've had a busy week again, I'll tell you what. But... Yeah. God's good, and that's the way it rolls in a small town. So.
Yeah, we tried to get out episode 4 Thursday.
Yeah.
Couldn't get that done, so now we're on Sunday.
I felt really bad about that. David waited around for me all day, and I never showed up.
That's okay. We'll try and do it again this Thursday and
that's
try and
right.
get everything going.
It'll work.
I want to do some house cleaning right quick, because now that we're on iTunes...
Uh-huh.
And Stitcher.
Uh-huh.
So the handful of people that are actually listening,
uh-huh.
Here's what we need you guys to do. Go on to either iTunes or go on to Stitcher or wherever you're getting the podcast. Give us some feedback. Review us. Give us some star ratings, whatever. Tell us we're horrible. Tell us we're great. Whatever it is. Because that's going to help us to reach more people.
Wait a minute. Do we want them to tell us we're horrible? I'm not too sure about that. I don't know if my fragile psyche can handle that. No, I'm joking.
Well, but you know, yeah, if you flame us too hard, we're going to talk about you on the show.
That's right. This is for you, troll number one. Wow.
So you want to start us out with some news, Jeremiah?
Sure, let's do some news.
Now, the news.
Well, the biggest rage going on right now, it's on the cover story of CNN, the cover story of Fox News, and the cover story of Huffington Post is about the LA Clippers owner, Donald Sterling. Have you all heard about this yet?
Nah.
It's pretty crazy. Actually, so Donald Sterling pretty much is an old man, right? He looks like he's in his 70s. I have a picture of him right here. I'm looking. And he has a very beautiful, young, petite girlfriend. That's his girlfriend right there. Can you believe that? I'm surprised. She's like 20 years old. He must be really rich. That's all I'm thinking. So, and his girlfriend, who is half black, is having an argument with him. And she records it and sends it out. And he makes all these racist comments, like... horribly. So I'll just read you the headline. Pretty much it says, Los Angeles Clipper owner Donald Sterling told his girlfriend he didn't want her to bring black people to his games or post pictures with black people on her Instagram, according to unverified audio obtained by TMZ.
Wow.
The tape begins in the middle of an argument between Sterling and his girlfriend, Stevanio. Sterling appears to be upset that Stevanio, who is black and Mexican, has been posting photos to Instagram of herself with black people, in particular Magic Johnson. And I'm just kind of shocked about this whole thing. I mean, it's like a 9-10 minute rant on, you know, we shouldn't be associating with those people in the public eye. You can admire them privately, but don't look at them. And you can, I'm not going to play the clip for you because it has certain words that, you know, I don't know. They're not good. So, anyways, but it's pretty shocking. And so all these people are like coming out. Michael Jordan's pretty much, he says it's ridiculous. Obama made a comment and said that he's ignorant. LeBron James came out.
The president says, slaps you down.
Yeah, pretty much.
He's not a Clippers fan anyway.
I know. I imagine he's like a Bulls fan or something. Yeah. He should be a Bulls fan. But, he's from Chicago, right?
So how do you own a basketball team and have those kind of views?
Exactly. Oh. She even says in the clip, which I listened to, you have a whole team of black people. And he goes, yeah, but I pay those people and I take care of them and I clothe them and all this stuff. And, you know, I don't associate.
Wow.
And that was his take on it. And I'm like, how in the world? I'm wondering what this girlfriend sees in this guy at all, because, like, she's half black. I mean, and he's saying, I don't associate with those people, yet here's my girlfriend. Anyways, I think he's kind of crazy. But LeBron James actually said there's no room for him in the NBA. And then the Clippers actually came out in their last game with their jerseys inside out and black armbands in support of fighting against their owner. So it's this big hubbub and to-do, and it really is interesting because it comes on the other side of, do you remember that the other thing in the news as far as racism is concerned is that Tea Party activist, I forget his name, from Nevada, who made all these horrible racist comments. So racism is kind of like big in the news right now. Yeah, limelight again. And so
it always just floors me whenever this type of stuff comes up, because you know, it's like in the day and age that we live in, that people can't see past this color of people's skin.
It's unbelievable. I mean,
what is up with that?
And even in our small town, I mean, small town North Texas, it's still, when I moved here from Reno, I was really kind of culture shocked again, because, you know, I heard those, some statements and comments, and I'm going, man, that's
crazy. You know, it used to be a big thing in the Christian community.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it used to be like no mixing of races and,
right,
and that sort of thing. But I always, that baffled my mind, because you can go back into the Bible. There's a situation there where Moses marries an Ethiopian woman.
Right.
Okay. Now, being from Ethiopia, she's going to be dark complected, you know, black lady, and Miriam is not all. Miriam and Aaron aren't happy with this situation, and they have words about it. And God basically tells them, "Sit down and shut up."
Shut up. That's right. That's right. So. It's pretty interesting, you know, and you know, even this last year, I had, when I was teaching on racism, I had to teach on racism because it was I do questions and answers sometimes with my youth. I'll have them send in questions, and one of the questions was, is it okay for a black guy and a white woman to date? I mean, that was a question that one of them had, and so.
No, but it's okay for a white man and a black woman?
Right. So it's definitely, you know, that's all right. But on the other side, you flip those genders, it's totally not. No. But you know, I took them back and showed them that, where did we come from? Were we black or white when we were, when God created us? Because there's startling evidence that says that everybody was, that Adam and Eve, I believe Adam and Eve were black.
Oh, yeah.
So
I'd never really heard that.
I haven't either.
Actually, it's new one for me. If you look at your genetic makeup, you can get white people from black people, but you cannot get black people from white people.
Really?
Yeah.
I'd never really.
And now that we've traced our DNA back to one source, which they have, they've traced the human genome. They trace it back, of course, to
the master race.
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly. No. Which is, you know,
isn't Hitler surprised?
I don't think that he would agree with the science at all. He would probably argue it, but anyway. So yeah, poor LA Clippers. They'll probably have to fire that guy or try to find another owner.
He's the owner. How do you?
I don't think they can fire him.
That's gonna be interesting.
Yeah, I don't know what the commish is gonna do on that whole thing. You know, because what do you do? Do you kick the team out? Like, how do you punish the owner? That's tough. Anyways, all right. So the second story I had for us is Pope Francis, the awesome Pope. This week in the news, he actually venerated two new saints. But what I really wanted to focus on was his instance of calling people out of the blue. It's really interesting. Pope Francis gets, of course, fan mail. Like, tons of people write into him and say all this stuff. And so...
You're the best pope ever.
That's an awesome hat, dude.
There's a hashtag, actually. I've seen it. Heart the Pope or something. Heart the Pope. I just saw that this week.
He's kind of like the rock star pope here. I mean, seriously, people are loving because he's kind of shaking things up a little bit. Some of his reforms I don't agree with, and some of them I totally do. So, you know, he seems to be a lot more... he's kind of a liberal pope, which is really interesting. Oh, but yeah. Especially coming on the heels of Pope Benedict there. Pope Benedict was, like, stern. Anyways, so for those of you who aren't Catholic, who don't write into Pope Francis gets fan mail, and he opens it and reads it, and he has a custom of calling people who write him fan mail. Can you imagine you're sitting there in your easy chair, you're chilling out, and all of a sudden the phone rings, right? You pick it up and it's like, hey, it's Pope Francis. What's up, man? Yeah. Because I imagine that's exactly how Pope Francis
That conversation talks. Goes, yeah, right.
Put down the phone, Dad. It's ridiculous. Pope Francis. So anyways, he's been talking to these people, and I guess it's called some custom speculation because he's reversed some rulings of some people in local churches. So I'll read you this headline. Pope Francis's habit of picking up the phone and cold calling people who write him is landing the Vatican in hot water. And spokesperson Federico Lombardi has had enough.
That Pope and his antics.
But his name is Federico Lombardi. You have to say it like this. You know, Italian accent. What's up with the Pope? He needs to quit it. You know, anyway, sorry. That was stupid.
Got an offer you can't refuse.
That's right. So Lombardi said on Thursday the calls were part of the Pope's personal pastoral relationships and do not in any way form a part of the Pope's public activities. So I thought that was really cool. The Pope cold calling people and, you know, landing the Vatican in hot water because of it. That crazy Pope, he needs to be grounded. Anyways, so the last one I have is...
Well, hang on a second. I had something I read or I heard this week about the Pope.
Oh, yeah.
And that there is supposedly a 900-year-old prophecy buried in the Vatican.
I like your premise just from the start. That's great.
Bear in mind that this is coming from... sources that, you know, these are conspiracy theorist people.
Sure.
But anyway, this thing that was buried in the Vatican was this 900-year-old prophecy that listed every pope that would ever come. And this particular one, what's his name?
Pope Francis.
Francis. He is the last one mentioned in the prophecy.
No way. It's crazy. Has anybody sent that to Pat Robinson yet? I knew it!
I wrote a book!
That's amazing.
It pays to listen to us regularly.
That's right.
To catch the inside jokes.
Dig deep in into our repertoire. What are we, three audios into this? So, all right. So the last thing I have... every week I've been digging into the Huffington Post and CNN and Fox News to bring you, you know, what's cool and new in the Christian news. And I came across a really interesting blog. It's called Tea Party Jesus. And this is the headline, blog puts words of conservatives in the mouth of Christ. Okay, so if you ever look this up, Tea Party Jesus, just Google it, and what you'll pull up is what you'll pull up are these pictures of Jesus, like these old timey pictures of Jesus with little word box coming out of his mouth. Like the one I'm looking at right now is Jesus, and he's reaching down to help a poor beggar, right? And but in the word box is a quote from a conservative. A conservative Tea Party person. And this is Rush Limbaugh's quote. We've already donated to Haiti. It's called the U.S. income tax. Oh, wow. That is so harsh. And I'm wondering, you know, I imagine most of these are totally taken completely out of context.
Okay, wait, who's producing this?
I imagine
it's... It's not the Tea Party, right?
No, it's got to be some liberal. Okay. But it's got to be somebody in the Democratic Party. But it's still, I mean, these are so, so horribly funny and terrible. Let's see, I'll find you another one here. I was looking, okay. It's a picture of Jesus, and he's pulling in nets with a big smile, and it's from Ann Coulter.
Right, right.
And it says, "I think the government should be spying on the Arabs, engaging in torture as a televised spectator sport, dropping daisy cutters wantonly throughout the Middle East, and sending liberals to Guantanamo." So harsh. I think it's so funny, though, because the picture of Jesus in the backdrop, and this is what I'm like, it brought up something very interesting, a thought to me. If people were to take my words and quote them and put Jesus' picture beside them, would I represent Christ rightly? Or would I not represent
Christ? Oh, man, I don't want that to happen for me.
I don't either, but that's exactly what's happening right here. And it's pretty amazing and kind of scary. Another one, Glenn Beck. "You know, it took me about a year to start hating the 9/11 victims' families. Took me about a year. I don't think I could hate victims faster than 9/11 victims." I mean,
wow.
That's a quote, and I imagine it's completely out of text, but, or context, but but still, it's just shocking. I don't think I'd like to... like to have my words put into Jesus' mouth.
These are terrible, man.
Have you?
Yeah, there's one from Bill O'Reilly here. "I couldn't get over the fact that there was no difference between Sylvia's restaurant and any other restaurant in New York City. Yeah. I mean, it was exactly the same, even though it's run by blacks, especially the black patrons. Oh. There wasn't one person shouting, 'Hey, MF-er, I want some more iced tea.'"
That's so bad.
I can't believe Bill O'Reilly said that. Well, I don't know.
I imagine, you know, that's what they're saying that he said. And I imagine there's got to be some, like, context or something. But, I mean, this is harsh.
But, hey, it takes it back to the first story. We need to be careful what we're saying, because never know when it might be put in a
that's right.
Tea Party Jesus or... And all then, over all over world news because of a fight we had with our spouse or girlfriend.
Yeah. Right.
Or immortalized in a podcast.
Right. Oh, yes.
Exactly. So that, you know, that started getting me thinking on the fact that, you know, I record myself every week. I really... So this will be my last week here at the theater. I'm joking. It's but we definitely need to watch what we say out there, Christians. So, anyways.
It goes back to that old adage, before you do anything, are you comfortable with it being on the front page of the news?
Right.
What's that old wives' advice? I like that.
One more by Mike Huckabee. Ready for this? "The only thing worse than a tour d'affaire with sweet, sweet Nancy Pelosi would be a tour d'affaire with Helen Thomas. If those were my only options, I'd probably be for same-sex marriage."
Wow.
Woo! Oh,
man.
Careful there, Mike.
Anyway. So this brings up another question.
Yeah.
How involved should Christians be in politics?
Oh, my goodness.
Dun, dun, dun.
That might be a very good topic for a full-on podcast, because I'm telling you, that's a good question.
Yeah.
I read a really good book a long time ago, like back when I was 21. And it was God's Politics was the name of the book. It was really good. Like, it just opened up my eyes to a lot of stuff. Because back then, like, it was 2001, 2002 was really like the big conservative push back when everybody was backing Bush and the war in Iraq and all that. And conservatives were like the, you know, the dominant thought, and you know, Christianity was under that. And I actually heard pastors from the pulpit, you know, condoning and not condoning, but publicly, you know, showing, all right, we need to support Bush, we need to support this and this and this.
Right, and that's what I'm kind of getting at. I mean, I tend to support people that hold the same type of moral values.
Sure.
And but the thing is, does it make people, like, for example, if we can legislate the things we believe in, like, Okay, for one, I'm huge against abortion.
Yeah, me too.
So,
me too. How about you?
Yes.
Okay, just making sure. Just making sure. Everybody, everybody agrees here. Abortion is bad.
Wait a minute. I thought you were pro-choice.
No. No.
Okay. So, but just using this as an example, though, if it's illegal, how does that change society, really? Huh. If you think about it, I mean, sure, my views are getting right. put out there into law,
right.
but does that promote the message of Christ anymore?
Right.
I mean, I'm not saying I don't want it illegal. I'm just saying that if we make that all our life, that my Christian job is to make sure that abortion is illegal.
Yeah.
Then is it going to stop abortion? Is it going to change people's hearts?
Right.
So I don't know. I have two different views about the whole.
One of my favorite quotes I've ever heard on politics from a Christian is a guy by the name of Rich Mullins way back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
He was talking on a news radio and he was talking about how he really at one point put his whole heart into politics. He thought, you know, and he said, you know, when it comes down to it, the school. The public school system is not going to change the world. The politics, the government is not going to change the world. The only thing that's supposed to change, it's going to change the world that God has ordained is the church. And that's what we need to be focused on. And I thought, man, that's a really good point. You know, politics won't save you. Politics aren't going to, you know, you might... We want to make this a Christian nation. I understand that. I get our heritage, but far more than that, we need to, you know, we need to be living it and not, I don't know, not...
Well, and the flip side of that is, how long have we been a so-called Christian nation? I mean, we wear that label pretty much, but how is that affecting the lives of the people that live here? You know, do we have just a lot of people going to church wearing a label?
Right.
Or do we have people following Christ? So, I don't know. I think it's something worth pondering.
It's kind of interesting you brought that quote. I was listening to a sermon this week, and they were saying the same thing, except they took it even further. They said not even the local congregation, but the family, and how there's a model of family and how just taking of your family and having your family exemplify Christ in everything they do, that's way more important than being involved in politics and a lot of that.
Well, 12 guys, through the power of the Holy Spirit, changed the whole planet.
That's amazing.
And
that still gives me goosebumps, by the way.
So you know, it wasn't through the Senate of Rome either.
Right.
It was grassroots, you know. That's
and it was through blood in the Colosseum.
Right. Well, right. That had a big impact on so many people when they would see the Christians dying in the Colosseum.
For their faith, man. That's pretty amazing.
What was supposed to be entertaining turned out to be moving.
Right.
So all of a sudden, wow, those people are singing hymns as they're being eaten by lions. What?
That's amazing. And I cry because, you know, the guy at my school is, you know, making fun of me because I'm a Christian or whatever.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing.
You've been so persecuted.
Yeah, so harsh. Anyway, so that's what's in the news in and around our government. So
cool.
Yeah.
Well, the topic that I wanted to talk about. Well, we talked about Passover last week and how Passover was a symbol of Christ. There's a whole field of theology that focuses on this, and that's Christology.
Christology.
Which,
it's about crystals.
Yes, it's about magic crystals and mushrooms.
Mushrooms? Really? Where did that come from? Mushrooms.
I don't know. But
eating some mushrooms.
Yeah, I loaded up on mushrooms before I started this podcast. So the idea.
Whoa, that's amazing. All right. Anyways. So
the idea of Christology is the study of Christ. It's the study of how Christ-centered the Bible is. And so, and not only the Bible, but there are other aspects that you can look at signs in the heavens being symbols of Christ, all kinds of stuff.
That's interesting.
Signs so, in heaven. But so what I wanted to talk about is, what are some things that we've run across, or maybe in our studies, that through the study of prophecy or the study of symbols, types, you know, figures, metaphors. We talked about figures of speech before. What things have we looked at in our studies where all of a sudden it's like, wow, that's talking about Jesus, even though it was written in the Jewish text of the Old Testament?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the biggest ones for me is, you know, Isaiah 53,
right?
Which is a whole chapter about Christ, which I love. And definitely, I mean, you can see, if you take the Bible as one big book, as a saga, mm-hmm. right? You can see the story of Christ throughout the entire thing from beginning to end.
Right.
He was there in the beginning, according to John. All things were created through him. And then you see the picture, especially right at the fall, and then all the way up. It's almost in every Bible story to me, you almost see a picture of Jesus somewhere in it. We talked about, like last week, we talked about the Passover.
Mm-hmm.
So we have Moses starting this whole thing where there's a sacrificial lamb, right? And they paint the blood over the doorpost. Right, so those right. staying in the doorpost, the firstborn son doesn't die in that.
And so now God's firstborn son dies as the lamb, and his blood covers our hearts the same way the blood covered the door.
And I mean, that's not a coincidence, and that happened how many years before Jesus was even born?
Yeah, thousands.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you've got that, and then, I mean, the whole story of Abraham.
Right. Well, let's jump back for a second, because you said that it starts way early in Genesis.
Oh, yeah.
Like think about the fall.
Right.
Even in there, some people will say the first prophecy of Jesus is in Genesis 3, which is talking about the fall,
right?
Where God's basically handing out the punishments,
sin's consequences,
right, for their actions. And you know, do you have it pulled up there?
I do.
see, there's a passage there. It talks about where God is talking to the serpent.
Then the Lord said to the serpent, "Because you have done this, you are cursed more than any livestock and more than any wild belly. You will move on your, or wild animal, not wild belly. maybe I've been eating mushrooms. All right. More than any wild animal, you will move on your belly and eat dust all the days of your life. I will put hostility between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He will strike your head and you will strike his heel." Right.
Right. So, okay, that is pretty much the first prophecy of Jesus Christ given right. by God himself, who, if you think of what is the seed, he says there's going to be enemies between Satan's seed and the woman's seed, Eve's right. seed. Now, we all know through biology that the man has a seed, not the woman. So this is a prophetic implication of the virgin birth.
Right.
And so you have, you know, this conflict that's going to exist between Satan and Jesus, born of a virgin. And so then it says that you will she bite will. His heel, but he will stomp your head, basically. Right. And that's an indication of the cross, of what happened there. It seemed to be a victory for Satan, but it turned out to be a defeat.
Right.
It turned out to be a victory for Jesus.
Right.
Through the resurrection.
Well, so you can even see in Genesis, right after the, I've always heard, right after the sin, right after the fall, what happens? God kills two.
Oh yeah, yeah. He gives them clothes.
Right, he gives them clothing.
They're in leaves.
I'm looking for.
And he gives them animal clothes. Well, right. It's unspoken in scripture, but how did the animal clothes come to be. God had to kill animals and shed blood to cover their sin.
There must be a blood shed for the remission of sin.
Life was lost. Exactly. Blood was shed in order to cover their sin.
Right.
So, yeah.
And this is in, I mean, that's in Genesis 4, I think, in Genesis 3.
It's almost like every page of the Bible, if you look at it, is going to talk to Jesus.
Right. It always points
to
Jesus.
It's really cool.
I mean, it's a cross-centered book. And it's a lot like, it's, I think it's amazing if we look, let's take a look outside of Scripture real quick. Let's look at the movies we watch, right? Mm-hmm. Or the stories we tell.
Mm-hmm.
Every single story I can think of, really, almost has a Christ-like figure. Every single one.
Right.
Right? Take Star Wars for existence, right? Our existence. Take Star Wars for example. You have, you can call Luke Skywalker the Christ, you know, centered person. The first movie he conquered, or first thing he conquers, the second one he falls, mm-hmm. right? And he ends up, finds out his dad is, you know, Vader, and then in the third movie he rises again and conquers.
Right.
Again, right?
Right?
I mean, it's amazing. And to me, it's all through our history as people. We have that ingrained story inside us to tell.
Good defeating evil.
Right. Even the Matrix. I mean, the crazy Wachowski brothers.
That's right.
That's nuts. But that's a great example.
Yeah. They even finished the whole series with him in a cross-like... Cross, yeah.
Carries Ellen Cross.
Well, and like Man of Steel had lots of references
to
Jesus. And like even his father saying, it's time to go save them, son. And he steps out of the spaceship in the symbol of a cross as he's floating through space. It's like, okay.
I was actually, I read an interview. I'm a big comic book nerd. I love comics. And I was reading an interview from a Christian comic book writer, a storyteller, and he worked on Spider-Man. I forget his name. I'm really bad with names, but you can Google it and find out. Anyways, so he was talking, he was doing an interview, and he said, you know, what I love about storytelling is, as a Christian, I can see throughout pretty much all the comics I've read and told, I can see a picture of Jesus in all of them.
Mm-hmm.
I can see, you know, the hero, you know, he always has to fall and then rise again.
Right.
It's this amazing picture over and over to me of Christ.
Yeah, where do we get these stories? Where do they come from?
Exactly.
And like you mentioned before, it's even crazy when you look at the details, like Abraham and Isaac. Abraham and Isaac is one of them that...
That's a really good one.
You know, we've got this situation where God tells Abraham, I need you to take your only son, and technically he wasn't his only blood son, but he was the only son of promise that God had made. And he said, I want you to take your only son and sacrifice him to me. Now, God had made all these promises to Abraham about, you're going to be the father of nations, and it's going to be huge, and you've got one guy to do this through.
Right.
And now Abraham's over 100 years old, And he's like, all of a sudden, I need you to kill that son of yours.
Can you imagine being Abraham that time? I just recently taught this to the kids. We're walking through the Old Testament and looking for Christ through the Old Testament, by the way.
Oh, really?
And which is kind of neat. Right now we're on Jacob and Esau, and we're about to come to where Jacob wrestles the angel.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And we're going to talk about that a little bit. But we just went over this. We spent 4 weeks on Abraham's walk up to the point of Isaac, right? He's learning what it means to have faith.
Right. Well, and if you look at all the details in that story, it continually points to Calvary. I mean, there's like one thing after another.
Yeah.
The boy had to carry his own wood on his back up the hill where he was going to die.
Yeah.
And one of the things I think is cool about it is God just didn't say, hey, take him out back and kill him. He said, I'm going to tell you a place. It's going to take you 3 days to get there.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
3 days. Now, if God tells Abraham, I need you to kill your son, almost to do this, he would have to kill him in his mind. I mean, it would have to be like, okay,
Right.
You know, so in Abraham's mind, Isaac is dead at that dead point, already. Right?
Yeah.
So what happens 3 days later? He's resurrected back to Abraham.
That's so good. I never thought about that. That's
and,
pretty cool.
And anyways, just one thing after another.
And it's pretty cool that he takes him to actually the place that later will become, it's Jehovah Jireh, right?
Yeah, the Mount Moriah.
Mount Moriah, which he names Jehovah Jireh, right. Which means God will provide,
uh-huh.
Right?
And it is in
Jerusalem.
Jerusalem.
That's right. Well, where did Jesus die?
Right.
Exactly.
And there's even been some really interesting studies whenever you look at, for example, Mount Moriah. He's climbing it, and he says he saw the place from afar. Well, if you're climbing a mountain, what place of the mountain do you see from afar?
The peak.
Pretty much the peak of it.
Yeah.
The highest point of Mount Zion, which is the same mountain, but yeah. Much later, the highest point on it is, strangely enough, 777 kilometers high from sea level. And it is located, it is the exact point where Gordon's Calvary was discovered in Jerusalem. So
you're blowing my mind.
So right now. You have Abraham sacrificing Isaac, or about to, in the probably the exact same place that wow. Jesus would die years later. And
it's amazing.
And you know, you're talking about, like, on the way up the hill, the boy says, "Dad, here's the wood. We got everything."
I was just going to read that. I'll read that real quick.
Read it. Do you have the King James Version? Because there's something about that and I'm not a huge King James
only guy. Yeah, you are. Only guy. King James only.
But there's something interesting about the King James that I think a lot of the other versions miss.
All right, so starting in verse 7. And Isaac spake unto Abraham, his father, and said, "My father." And he said, "Here am I, my son." And he said, "Behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" And Abraham said, "My son, God will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering." So they both went, both of them together.
There is a cool play on words that happens in the Hebrew, and for whatever reason, the King James translators, they got the play on words translated well into English, which is this: God will provide himself a sacrifice. Wow. So there's two ways of reading that. You can read it in the service level, which is God will take care of this.
Right.
Or you can read it on the flip side,
himself,
where Abraham's actually prophesying God will become the sacrifice.
That's right.
He will provide himself a sacrifice.
It's amazing to me how far back is this in history before Jesus? This is what, 2,000 years?
Yeah, right? Yeah. It's a ways.
So it's just amazing. Anyways, so definitely.
Oh,
see.
Yeah. And Moses. You know, we talked about Moses coming out of Egypt and how that was a sign, but there were other things that he did that symbolized Christ all throughout the process. You know, we all know the story of how Moses struck the rock,
right,
and was not allowed
in anger.
Yeah, and so it's like it's always been kind of fascinating. It's like, okay, Moses on the whole did what God wanted him to do. Why all of a sudden, because of one mistake, would he not let him into the promised land?
Huh.
But I think that there's something bigger happening here that had a bigger impact. This type of thing happened twice. The first time, he was told to strike the rock.
Right.
Okay. If you start looking through scriptures, you'll find the symbol of the rock used many times, and it's always a symbol of Jesus Christ, wherever it is. So you have, okay, this rock being struck and it providing
water,
life-giving energy to the people, right?
Yeah.
So that's a symbol of Jesus being struck and his blood pouring out and us receiving the benefits of that. Okay, but the second time he encounters this situation, he's told, speak to the rock. Now, if we think about Jesus has gone off the earth, when are we going to see him again? Huh. Is he going to be struck? You know, he told his disciples, no one knows the hour of my coming except for God, not even the angels. So if that's the case, how is Jesus going to know to come back? Huh. God's going to speak to him.
Yeah.
And so he'll come back.
I've never seen that before. That's pretty cool.
So God's made a model here.
Right.
And he was like, okay, the first time you strike the rock, the second time I need you to speak to it. Well, Moses goofs up and strikes the rock. And so even though it still went ahead and gave the water, it broke God's model that he was trying to make. And so I think that had a bigger implication of why he was upset with Moses to such a degree.
That's interesting. I never thought of that before. I've always heard, you know, the reason he wasn't allowed in the promised land was because he struck it out of anger, because he was frustrated that the stupid Israelites who kept, you know...
And his pride, because he kept saying,
right,
I have to fetch the rock from the water from the rock, you rebels.
Right. I think. Yeah. Anyways, but
So what else have you guys looked at that has jumped out at you before?
I was just looking at Isaiah 53 again. To me, that's just so powerful. Mm-hmm. I don't understand how anybody can read that and not think Christ.
Right.
When they read it.
Well, they think Christ, they just don't think Jesus.
Right. I mean, Jesus, the Christ. Yet he himself, verse 4, yet he himself bore our sickness, he carried our pains, but we in turn regarded him stricken, struck down by God and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions, crushed because of our iniquities. Punishment for our peace was upon him, and we are healed by his wounds. I mean, that's a...
Right. And by his stripes we are healed. Yeah, and Jesus was scourged.
Right.
I mean, there's all these pictures, things that Jesus fulfilled in that.
Right.
And even in the verses surrounding it, like I believe it's chapter before or after that, where it talks about how his beard would be plucked out and all this. And you had him being beaten Jesus being beaten in the trial in the middle of the night. And that was completely illegal, but it fulfills prophecy that was written right in there.
Yeah, I mean, the virgin birth was prophesied in that. It's pretty amazing. I was thinking about what can you tell us about the sacrificial lamb? Once a year, the high priest would sacrifice.
The Day of Atonement.
The Day of Atonement.
Well, yeah, that's an obvious symbol of Christ as well. And right. Well, the whole book of Hebrews addresses all that. Right. You know, it talks about how the things that are here are models of what is in heaven, and so they're imperfect here. And that if the blood of goats and bulls couldn't take away, you know, sin, then we needed the real deal. We needed Jesus to do that.
That's good.
And so, yeah, I think that every part of that process talks to Christ. All of this, the symbols inside the tabernacle, you've got the lampstand, which is the light of the world, right? Or the light, and John 1 says that Jesus was the light and the darkness didn't understand it.
Right.
And then you've got the bread, the show bread. And what's Jesus say? I am the bread of life.
Right.
You know, so it's like one thing after another. You've got the altar of incense there in the middle. And in Isaiah 6, where Isaiah gets a glimpse of this temple, or the throne room, he's already in the temple. And he gets a glimpse of the throne room of God while he's there.
Right.
And all of a sudden, he feels like, I'm unworthy to be here. I'm a sinner.
Woe is me. I'm a man of unclean lips, and I dwell amongst the people of unclean lips.
Right. And he fell down and was like, I'm not going any further. But the seraphim, or the angel, came down. And what did he do? He took a coal
from the
altar of incense, because everything in the altar, in the tabernacle or the temple, had been consecrated so that it could be in God's presence. And that's why Nadab and Abihu died, because they didn't use the incense from the altar. They used unconsecrated incense, which made the users unclean. Well, now
it was strange fire,
and that's yeah. and that's exactly what Isaiah was scared of. Was right. I'm not in a clean state.
Right.
I need to be cleansed before I can come into God's presence. And so, what does the angel do? He grabs the coal, yeah. and he touches it to Isaiah's lips because he said, "I've got unclean lips."
That's right.
So he touches him, and it cleanses him, and gives him the ability to come in. So that's a symbol of Christ too. When we're touched by Christ, He cleanses us from our sin.
Well, yeah. Well, think about
that. Consecrates us, and then we can be in God's presence.
Exactly. In fact, the very last chamber in the temple, the Holy of Holies,
right
is separated by that gigantic curtain,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
And in that, the Holy of Holies dwells the Ark of the Covenant, the mercy seat. So once a year, you have the high priest go in and sprinkle the sacrificial lamb's blood without spot, without blemish. Another picture of Jesus who was without sin, right?
Right.
Sprinkles the blood on the high, you know, on the holy seat. And then, you know, I've heard this in tradition, and I've never really studied it. I've always just heard it. So I don't know how true it is or not, but they would tie a rope around the high priest's ankle.
I've heard that too. Right.
To whether he thought a thought or sinned a sin or something, if he died. They can pull him out without going into the Holy Holies because right. God was so holy and we were so unholy.
Well, and like, what is it? It's in Leviticus where it talks about the cleansing process.
Yeah.
It was so in depth of what Aaron and his sons had to do in order to be able to go into that place.
Right.
And it was like they had to spend 7 days in the holy place,
right.
just chilling out, eating holy bread or fasting or whatever it was.
Right.
But they had to like go through this whole cleansing process before they could be allowed to come into God's presence. And the first time they did it, blammo, they goofed up and and made themselves unclean and got struck down. Yeah. So it was like the second time.
So well, they knew better.
Aaron had two more sons, and he's right. like, "Okay, it's y'all's turn."
No pressure.
Don't worry about it. It'll be all right.
Can you imagine looking at each other going, "Man, why can't we be shepherds?" This is ridiculous.
So these guys go in there, and guess what? They goof up as well.
Yeah.
Because they were supposed to eat.
The showbread.
The sacrifice before right. they left. They were that's supposed right. to eat it, and they didn't.
Right.
Okay, but God didn't strike them dead. So what's the difference? Well, the difference is he didn't strike Nadab and Abihu down because of a mistake or because they disobeyed, but because they were unclean. These guys, their mistake did not make them unclean. They were just trying to get out of there as fast as they exactly. could.
Because they knew what happened to Nahum. That's good.
Right.
But okay, so you have that gigantic sheet or that separates the Holy of Holies. And what happens when Christ dies,
is sacrificed?
That's
yeah,
right.
It tears it.
From top to bottom. And I always have this picture in my mind of God reaching down, grabbing hold of that thing, and ripping it, you know, mm-hmm. and going, "It's over."
Yeah, because we don't have to worry about the same thing that Nadab and Abihu had to worry about.
Exactly.
Because we have been consecrated. We've been made clean.
Yeah.
And so therefore, we can be in the presence of God.
And our cleanliness is an everlasting cleanliness.
Yeah.
Which is beautiful. I think it's God himself did provide the lamb.
Right.
It was perfect.
Right.
It's great. I love that.
But man, there are so many. I mean, you could just go through the Old Testament. I mean, you know, the story of Jephthah is told in Judges 11.
And I don't refresh my memory there.
Okay, Jephthah, he's not as popular as, say, Samson from Judges or whatever. But
which is interesting. Just side note, you know the Bible, like the Bible movies that they did on, I don't know, Discovery or whatever.
Right. They skip all this stuff.
Yeah. Well, okay. So out of all the judges, they pick Samson. Mm-hmm. That makes no sense to me. Why would they pick?
Because he's popular. That's, I guess so. Everyone kind of knows the story.
Big tough guy.
Gideon's the best to me. Like yeah. that whole story is.
Oh,
like,
that is good.
That's the coolest judge. If I would have had it, I would have totally chosen Gideon. But
right.
Anyways,
well, there's some weird and cool stories in Judges. So if you haven't read Judges from front to back,
I love it.
Go do it because. Yeah. some of it is not PG rated either. So you have to be careful.
If they made movies out of all the judges, they would have to give some of them like X ratings because
it's messed up
like
stuff in there.
Ehud and Eglon, right? Where he stabs the king on a throne, which is, you know, where's your throne in your house?
And the concubine that gets sliced into a million pieces.
Scattered across.
Yeah, there's all kinds of weird stuff in there. But this story of Jephthah is a good model for Christ because, okay, you've got this guy. He's been called by God to be a deliverer, just like, you know, Samson or these other guys, because they were under the rule of, I believe, is the Midianites. But anyway, one of the cultures that were there in and around Israel had subdued the Israelites, and he was in battle with them, and it wasn't going all that well. And so he prays to God, and he says, if you will give me the strength to defeat this army, I will sacrifice to you the first thing that comes through the door of my house.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, God says, all right. But you got to be careful with what you promise God.
Right.
Because God, he provided. And Jephthah annihilated his enemies, came home. I don't know what he was expecting. If he had a bunch of animals living in the house, I don't know. But yeah. he comes home, and the first thing that comes out of his door is his only daughter.
That's right.
Okay, so now you've got another situation of a sacrifice with an only child.
A human sacrifice.
A human sacrifice.
Right.
And the thing is, you might think, oh, that's so creepy and messed up. Why would the Bible have that?
In fact, I was in a Bible study with some men almost a year ago. We read that story.
Mm-hmm.
And they were trying to work out around the fact that he had sacrificed his daughter.
Yeah, because it doesn't talk about that actual practice happening, but it happened because she's remembered. Yeah. It talks about how this is a memory to her. But the cool thing about it is, if we look at it, it's for the salvation of the people.
Yeah.
That's why she had to die. She had to die for a sacrifice for the people so that they would be saved.
Hmm.
And you add on top of that, she was a willing sacrifice. Jephthah broke down. He's like, I can't do this.
Right.
She says, no, if this is what you promised God, then I will submit to it.
Yeah.
Now that, talk about faith.
Yeah.
Right there. Okay, well then, what does she do? She goes, she says, just give me some time up into the mountain so I can mourn my youth and that sort of thing. So,
right. So
here you have a Garden of Gethsemane type of thing happening.
It is surprising she didn't run away in the mountains. Give me a couple days. Let me go up in the mountains and mourn my youth. So, well, she's supposed to be here by now. But I guess she's late. No, that didn't happen.
But it's cool that you know, it's like a model of what happened with Jesus. And this happens all throughout, you know, the Old Testament.
Yeah.
So, but there's one more that I think that I wanted to mention that is really... You have to, I didn't come up with this, I found this. This is so cool. But, you know, we've been talking about the Noah movie.
Yeah.
And
have you seen the Noah
Not
movie?
Not yet, no.
Oh, it's so fun to watch. Like, it's really just fun to watch. Because, especially if you go, my advice is to go in the afternoon when all the old people are there.
Oh, I bet. They're yelling at it.
That was so funny.
Hey, what happened?
Well, I never. I'll never forget hearing that. Like, right behind me. Anyways. Oh, man.
So, anyway, and I want to tie this in also with, you know, if you do a devotional or read the Bible in a year or something like that, I don't know if you've ever tried to do that, but reading the Bible straight through can be really hard.
Yeah.
Because you run into patches where it's like, okay, here's three chapters of genealogy.
Name after name after name.
Right. Or then here is the law in painstaking detail.
Right.
Of things that, you know, are gone now.
But it's like that Monty Python skit.
Right. The holy hand grenade
of
Andy.
3 days shall be, or 30 shall be the number of thy counting.
So a lot of Christians kind of write off passages of scripture as, oh, that's just a genealogy. Toss that out.
Right.
Well, I want to talk about a genealogy in Genesis, the 5th chapter. Now, this is from Adam to Noah.
Yeah.
And all chapter 5 is one of these boring genealogies. But a Jewish scholar went through... He must have had a lot of time on his hands. But he went through and he started analyzing.
I doubt he was married.
He was analyzing the names. So he was analyzing the names in the genealogy and looking at the Hebrew root words that made up the names. And it's pretty interesting. So bear with me as I go through some of these names.
Okay.
But it starts with Adam, because we know who Adam is. The name Adam, from the Jewish root word, means man. In fact, sometimes you'll even see, like if you're reading through somewhere and it talks about man in the Hebrew, it uses the word Adama, which is Adam.
Yeah.
So Adam means man. Adam had a son named Seth. And Seth's name means is appointed. And even when Eve has him, she says that. She said, you know, God has appointed me this child. So Seth means is appointed. Seth's son's name is Enos, which means mortal, just plain mortal. Huh. His son's name is Canaan, which means sorrow. Then his son's name is Mahalalel, which means...
That's an awesome name.
Mahalalel. Which means the blessed God.
Oh, that's a cool
name. So that's a cool name.
Yeah. I'm going to write that down for my baby names.
Okay. Mahalalel.
Yeah.
Mahalalel. That would be...
What's your name?
Mahalalel.
Mahalalel.
Or.
Yeah. So awesome.
So Mahalalel's son's name is Jared. So he was like, all right.
I'm sick of the kids making fun of me.
Ask Jared.
And that guy got sponsored by Subway and lost a ton of weight.
So Jared's name means shall come down, which doesn't make a lot of sense on its own, right? Okay, yeah. Enoch is Jared's son, and we know Enoch from okay, he didn't make it to death. God took the guy.
That's right.
He only lived 300 years versus everyone else living nearly 1,000.
Right.
And it's his name means teacher or teaching.
Hmm.
Then he had a son named Methuselah. Now we know Methuselah from being the oldest guy.
Yeah.
He lived 969 years or something, and the oldest recorded one. Well, Methuselah's name means his death will bring, which is really cool because Jude tells us in the New Testament that Enoch was a prophet.
Yeah.
Enoch names his son, his death will bring. And if you do the math, it's really cool. This is a side note, but if you do the math, Methuselah died in the exact same year that the flood happened. Huh. So it's like Enoch was prophesying the flood by naming his child.
They got that right in the movie, too.
Did they really?
Well, they killed him with the flood.
Well, that would make sense.
Yeah.
So, hey.
Wow.
So you just thought Noah was wrong.
Exactly. Come on, people. Come on.
Okay, so Methuselah, his name is his death will bring.
Yeah.
Okay, his son's name was Lamech, which means despairing.
Wow.
So, what a name to give your child.
Okay. You are going to be...
Oh, I didn't want this kid.
Despairing.
He's like, he's keeping me up all night. We're changing his name. So...
That's so awesome.
So, Lamech, his son's name is Noah. So, we know Noah. Okay, yeah. Noah's name means comfort. Now, the cool thing is, if you take these names in order, stretch them out end to end, and read what the names mean... Here's what it says. Man is appointed mortal sorrow, but the blessed God shall come down, teaching his death will bring the despairing comfort. It's a prophecy.
That's so creepy and awesome.
It's a prophecy of Jesus Christ.
Wow.
It's right there inside this genealogy.
That's so awesome.
Wow.
Can I get a copy of that?
Wow. That'll preach, right?
That will preach. That's great. I'm going to use that. Become Billy Graham on them. Cool. With that thing. That's pretty amazing. Wow.
So you guys got any others? I'm fresh out.
I don't think I can top.
I found one. It's not topping that, but it's stuck in the
sure.
It's stuck in the minutia of some of these boring verses. And I think you actually were the one who told me about this one about the camp of Israel.
Oh yeah.
I love this one.
That's a cool one.
This one's so cool. In Numbers 2, you read all these crazy numbers of where the camps are situated, and you can find this online too. I'm looking at it right now. And the numbers of each of the camps around the tabernacle.
Yeah.
And on the south side with Reuben, which is man, there's 151,000. On the north side, there's 158, roughly, 1,000 people. So you kind of got an equal-sized number of camps on either side of the tabernacle, south and north. And the west to east, you've got Ephraim on the west with 108,000 and Judah on the east with 187. So if they camped straight out from the tabernacle, which...
if God told you, camp east of the tabernacle, I'm not going to be northeast.
Right.
Right. I'm going to be straight
east. I don't want that Nadab and Abihu thing.
That's right. That's right.
But we saw those guys. We're going east.
So if you followed that pretty well, then you've got a pretty distinct shape of a cross with the camp of Israel.
So if you're flying over it in a helicopter, you see a cross laying on the ground.
Right.
Wow. That's cool.
Yeah, it's pretty mind-blowing. You can check it out. Just type in Google the camp of Israel shaped like a cross or something. There's all kinds of support for that.
Because you can't get that just by reading the text. I mean, you have to start doing some math and laying it out. But it shows you that God has a plan for all this stuff that he's telling them to do.
Yeah.
That it has this... because that just goes deep and deeper and deeper. Because what's at the tabernacle? Sacrifice for sin.
Right.
Right in the middle of the cross.
That's beautiful. Yeah. You ever heard of laminin?
Yes.
You have heard of laminin?
Yes.
Was it like linoleum?
No.
I'm sorry.
like sheep wool? No.
I think I've heard of it.
Type in laminin in your...
L-A-M-I-N-I-N,
I think.
Let me see if this is what I'm thinking it is. All right. Are major proteins in the basal lamina, a protein network foundation for most cells and organs.
It's the foundation of all cells, pretty much. What it is a cohesive unit that holds our cells, very cells together is laminin. Okay, if we didn't have laminin, we'd just disperse.
Okay, right? So it's like glue.
Cool.
Yeah, look at laminin.
Oh, it's shaped like a cross. That's cool.
It's so amazing. A molecular biologist discovered that, and he was just blown away by that. It does. It looks, and they have, they have it under microscope, and they see the cross is what holds us, our very beings, together.
That's super awesome.
I mean, if that doesn't tell you that God is the author of this amazing story.
Oh, cool. And there's a verse by this one, Colossians 1:17. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together.
Yeah.
Wow.
So amazing. That's cool. I hold that to that.
That's... So this whole Christology thing, I mean, it can get really cool.
I mean, you can find it everywhere.
And it's almost like it's never ending.
No.
I mean, you could just keep digging and keep finding stuff that ties into Christ. So.
Yeah, God is the greatest Easter egg author, right? He puts Christ in
first,
Easter
I was
eggs
thinking,
all over the place.
I was thinking back to our last episode about Easter eggs. But no, okay, I get what you're saying.
So maybe that's what we should teach whenever we show Easter eggs. Check out these Easter eggs. Right?
Air quote.
Right. Sorry, I forget. You can't see us. Air quote.
Yeah, so, okay.
That's good.
Well, okay. Well, that's going to about sum us up for this episode of Theonauts. We're going to try and get another one before the week is over. Keep this thing going.
We will do it.
Make sure you give us some stars. Vote for us, whatever they call it, and give us some reviews. Oh, and give us voicemail. Call us on the voicemail line. You got questions. You've got complaints. You've got... confusions you need us to
and if
clear
you're the
up.
Pope, we definitely want to hear from you.
Mad racist comments.
Maybe not them, but
I won't be here that day.
So, okay, well, that number is 972-885-7270. So thanks for joining us on the Theonauts. Jeremiah, thank you very much.
Thanks, David.
And thanks for being here, Stephen.
Yeah, thanks
for having me.
God bless you guys. We'll see you later.
Later days.
This has been the Theonauts Podcast. Call us with your questions or comments at 972-885-7270. 972-875-7270. That's 972-885-7270. We'd love to hear from you.